Thank you, Mr. Chairman, comrades and friends and opponents. My opponent has come here this evening in order to perform what can only be regarded as a rather morbid task. She has come to convince you that you should be prepared to die for Britain. Now, indeed, this fatal course of action is not just the obscene product of my opponent's imagination. The practical acceptance by the major governments of the world of military policies which could lead to the annihilation of millions of human lives leaves every one of us as a candidate, whether we support our opponent or do not, for the mass human wreckage which a future world war would most certainly produce. So we should be in no doubt at the outset that whether we agree that Britain is worth dying for or not, if things go on as they do, every one of us in this hall are the potential victims. To accept my opponent's proposition is to do more than to offer a dull nod of the head towards the idiocies of nationalist rhetoric. That in itself is harmless. To accept that Britain is worth dying for is to enter with complacency into the belief that natural resources and human energies must be squandered upon an unprecedented campaign of preparation for war. To accept the military status quo is to do nothing to change a world which can produce 4 tons of explosive per head of the global population, at the same time as a third of the world's population are starving, 30 million a year at the rate of the equivalent of one Hiroshima every 2 days. And to go along with my opponent is to follow her into a barbaric line of reasoning which regards violence and ultimately the sacrifice of human life as the most efficient means of resolving conflict. As a socialist, I stand in total and uncompromising hostility to the proposition that Britain, or indeed any other country, is worth dying for. It is my intention then to convince you that the workers of the world have no country either to be loyal to during life or to sacrifice ourselves for in war. For the workers of the world have got far more in common with each other, whatever may be written on our passports, than we will ever have with those who call upon us to die for the sake of their greed, plunder and imperial ambition. So let me make the position of the Socialist Party plain right at the outset. It is our view that every worker whose life is lost in the great scramble for profits has wasted his or her life. That every drop of worker's blood which is shed for the sake of nationalism is a stain upon the present social order, and that stain can only be removed by removing this social order. My opponent, in the spirit of the perverse Orwellian logic which was dominating capitalism long before 1984, tells you that we need bombs to preserve peace. If you want peace, according to her ladyship, prepare for war. The socialist answer to that logic is very simple, so simple that it has perhaps escaped my opponent's thought process. If you want peace, you prepare for peace. And the only way that you can prepare for peace is by eradicating the cause of war. And I propose to show that the cause of war lies within the present capitalist system of society, whether it is a private capitalism of the West or the state capitalism of the East. My purpose is to convince you that a social system which is geared to rivalry over control of the world market and ruthless competition between antagonists over the market is not a system which causes war by accident. It is a system which causes war as a matter of inevitability. I shall argue then that the world capitalist system, together with its nations, its flags, its armies, its torture chambers, and the equipment supplied for them by British and other governments, must be thrown onto the scrap heap of historical anachronisms. And in its place, we've got to establish a system of society based upon need and not profit, and upon the cultivation of life rather than the hideous preparation for death. So I'm arguing against nationalism because I've got no country, and for socialism because I've got a world to win. And let me say right at the outset to those who protest as they sing the words of the International to the tunes of the national anthem, that nationalism and socialism are not compatible. You have to have one or the other. And in arguing against nationalism and for socialism, I am very much aware of the conspicuous absence this evening of two groups of people at this debate. Firstly, there are those who have lost their lives because their minds were captured by the infectious illusion of nationalism. They were convinced that it was their duty to go out and fight. The 30 million who died between 1914 and 1918 in what was laughably called a war to end all wars. And after they fought and died to end all wars, then millions more went out, backed up by those great democratic allies, Churchill and Stalin, to fight a war that was meant to be for freedom and democracy. And then there are the young men, driven by the frustration of the dole queue, and perhaps even the hope of a certain amount of adventure in the possibility of legalised gang warfare, who joined the army and the navy. They joined it for a bit of adventure, and what did they see? They saw the bottom of the South Atlantic. The workers in uniform who were blown to pieces in the Falklands War, so that the leader of my opponent's party could build an image of iron strength upon the wasted corpses of young men out in the South Atlantic. Was Britain worth dying for them? Would they be cheering so passionately at the rhetoric of nationalism if they had their chance over again? The millions of soldiers whose wasted corpses stand as a grotesque symbol of patriotism are not here to know that they died in vain. They died as pawns in a game of political and commercial rivalry which had nothing at all to do with their human interests. But there are others who have survived, and if my opponent wants to learn, she should listen to them. The men and women who fought in two world wars to defend a madhouse called civilization, who are now existing on a pittance of a pension, and 10,000 of them last winter died for Britain. Not because there was a war on. They died of hypothermia, because having gone out and fought and been injured, and given their energies to fight for a country which they mistakenly believed was theirs. They couldn't even afford to switch on a heater, and they died. And my opponent should go and talk to workers who've come back from wars without limbs, with brain damage, with half their skin burnt off. And now that those ruined lives have been thrown onto the scrap heap of what are called the disabled, how many of them are counting their increased share dividends in Charrington Coalite, who own most of the Falkland Islands? How many of them are going out and investing their millions in the markets which they help to expand? Before my opponent and those like her indulge in the dangerous rhetoric of nationalism, let them remember that behind every flag-waving, slogan-chanting display of patriotism lies the reality of a military technology which grows more lethal as the capitalist requirement for profits becomes more voracious. And there's a second group of people who are not here tonight. The infants, the babies, the children, the potentially innocent victims who are the sitting targets of my opponent's bombs for peace. Nobody will ask them whether Britain is worth dying for. Nobody asks their parents whether they are prepared to sacrifice their children for the sake of their master's quarrels. If my opponent is asked to tell us, why do we have to have war? And if we argue it out for long enough, I think that it will come down to two words. And these are two of the most pernicious words in the political vocabulary. Human nature. All of the guns and the bombs, all of the concentration camps, these are a reflection of human nature. That's what they say. But is this so? Is it true that children are born with an innate propensity to hate enemies? I put it to my opponent that humans are born with a need to cooperate, not to fight, and that it is the present social order which needs to indoctrinate workers to believe that they've got enemies, which needs to drive it into our heads that these are your enemies today, and when your bosses have made a trade alliance with them, they are friends tomorrow. Is it true that babies in cots in China have got some kind of inborn animosity towards babies in cots in Russia, because Khrushchev fell out with Chairman Mao about 30 years ago? Is it true that Iranian and Iraqi children have got this natural hatred for each other? And is it true that our uniquely human rationality can allow us no better than to mature into thugs who can only solve our problems by maintaining a permanent threat of global destruction? Socialists reject entirely the conservative dogma that human behaviour is fixed into the mould of aggression and non-cooperation. The fact is that that aggression, that hatred, that nationalism is driven in to workers' minds against their better judgments at childhood. Why is it then that the present system of capitalism leads to war? Well, to answer this, we need to understand a few things about the system. To begin with, let's be quite clear. Capitalism does not exist in order to satisfy human needs. That is a myth. It exists in order to make profits for a minority, and if that minority cannot expect a profit, then humans are deprived of the satisfaction of basic needs. The chief object of the capitalist is to sell commodities on the market with a view to profit. And they will do this without any concern about ideology. Russia and South Africa fix the price of gold in quite happy trade collaboration every single day of the week. The United States and China are major trade partners, and Britain, quite prepared to trade with any of the people who are its alleged ideological enemies. In short, the race for profits goes on without ideology getting in the way. The patriotic garbage is put on show for the consumption of the working class. But I can assure you that the Swiss bank account class, the class which has had a massive transfer of capital to where labour power is cheaper and they can get a higher rate of profit, they certainly aren't concerned about such absurd sentiments as patriotism. So by and large, capitalist trade goes on without war. Periodically, however, the thieves fall out. And it's at that point that capitalist competition over markets, over trade routes, and over raw materials erupts into a parade of violence. And at such times, huge fortunes are spent on whipping up popular emotions of national chauvinism and hatred for the enemy. Millions of pounds are spent on showing the working class that the Russians are our enemies. Russians who we wouldn't know if we met them. That the Argies can't be trusted. Remember that? It's not so much in the press these days. And then, with utter cynicism, the rival capitalist states dress their wage slaves in uniform, pay the priests to bless the bombs, and having persuaded those with nothing to gain except a grave, there proceeds the legalised and morally sanctified killing of thousands or hundreds of thousands, or in the case of the war that awaits us, many millions of people. And let us be under no illusion, whatever the rhetorical justifications of the capitalists, those wars are fought for one reason: commercial gain. And in their more honest moments, which in the case of the present Minister of Defence hasn't yet occurred, they've said this. The capitalists have come out in the open and admitted that what the wars are all about is making a profit. Let me give you some examples. In 1890, Joseph Chamberlain, a conservative government minister, confirmed precisely what I as a socialist have been saying in a speech to the Birmingham Chamber of Commerce. Now, he must have been telling the truth there. No one tells lies in the Birmingham Chamber of Commerce. And he said, "All the great offices of state are occupied with commercial affairs. The Foreign Office and the Colonial Office are chiefly engaged in finding new markets and defending old ones. The War Office and the Admiralty are mostly occupied in the defence of these markets and for the protection of our commerce. And those whose relatives were killed fighting for Britain out in India, they'd be interested to hear what the Conservative Home Secretary in 1925, Lord Brentford, had to say about that. I quote, "We did not conquer India for the benefit of the Indians. I know it is said at missionary meetings that we conquered India to raise the level of the Indians. That is cant. We conquered India as the outlet for the goods of Great Britain. Again in 1939, my opponent might tell us that the war was fought to defend noble principles of democratic rights and fighting against Nazism. And I would be very interested if my opponent would tell me how much he agrees with the comment made in the open letter written by Churchill in the Daily Telegraph before the Second World War, when he wrote, I quote, "I have always said that if Britain were defeated in war, I hope that we should find a Hitler to lead us back to our rightful position among the nations," unquote. Was it then a war for democracy and for freedom, for human rights? Or was not the position more accurately summed up by the Conservative Minister of Overseas Trade in March 1939, when he said, "We are not going to give up any markets to anyone. Great Britain is strong enough to fight for markets abroad." That was what they fought for. And as a final quotation in support of the socialist analysis, and you'll notice that none of these come from these so-called rabid Marxists, all from my opponent's side. Let me quote from Smedley D. Butler. I mean, he must be from my opponent's side. He was a former major general in the United States Marine Corps. And he wrote, "I served in all commissioned ranks from a second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism." Major General in the United States Marine Corps in his own autobiography. And that is what they want us to die for. Now, my opponent might say we should be prepared to die to defend what is ours. Well, what is ours? Let's take a look at what is ours, and let's take a look at what ain't ours. Only 7% of the British population own any marketable stocks and shares. Not my figures, Inland Revenue 1980 support report. 93% of the British population own no stocks and shares which they can sell. I know we're meant to all be on pension funds, which you get when you die. Well, that's not quite enough. The poorest 80% of the British population, according to the Royal Commission report of 1979, said that the poorest 80% of the British population own less of the accumulated wealth than the richest 1%. Just 1% own more of Britain than 80% with everything we possess added together. A mere 2% of the British population own 64% of the land in this country. And I could carry on quoting statistics. Not our statistics, their statistics. I could carry on quoting them all night. But I don't have to do that to prove that workers have got no economic stake in capitalism. You know, without me having to tell you, that when they talk about defending our markets, they're not talking about Chapel Street Market. When they talk about defending our property, they're not talking about our rented video machines and the second-hand Cortina. Don't think they are. You'd need a pea shooter to defend that. The fact of the matter, Mr. Chairman, is that if the Russians sent an aeroplane over to Britain to rob from the working class what belongs to us, it'd cost them more in petrol fuel than they'd pick up in the whole of Islington. And let me just say this, that when I read in the Daily Telegraph, and I read the Daily Telegraph, and I just hope she reads the Socialist Standard. When I read the Prime Minister's New Year message to the nation, it was printed in the Reader's Digest, a famous intellectual journal. And she says, liberty and property are intricately bound up in our history. A country that has no property rights has no human rights. And I respond to that by saying that when property is concentrated into the hands of a parasitical minority, whether they are millionaire shareholders or whether they are state bureaucrats in the Kremlin, then it is fraudulent in the extreme to suggest that to die for property is to die for our liberty. So my opponent will just have to concede that if workers are to die for Britain, we'll be dying for their Britain, not for our Britain. And then, of course, there is the argument that we should be prepared to die to defend our way of life, our culture. Now, I must admit that I find it very odd to imagine that cruise missiles have been brought to Britain in order to defend the collected works of Shakespeare against a preemptive strike from the Pushkin Appreciation Society. Of course, workers don't have a way of life to defend. Why should we die in defence of McDonald's hamburgers and Dallas for us and the Ritz Hotel and Ascot for them, when instead there's a greater task before us to create a society where all people have free access to the best goods and services which human endeavour can provide? Why not put that as our aim? And imagine for a moment if these obscene weapons of destruction were used. Would they be defending our way of life? Would they be defending this so-called civilisation? In the Stockton Evening Gazette on the 12th of August last year, I read a report. And this is one of many illustrations of how these bombs for peace are going to defend our way of life. I quote, a doctor is recommending that victims of a nuclear attack should be stoned to death to put them out of their misery. Dr. Barney Williams, that is, has produced a controversial 10-point survival plan which he has been handing to patients at his surgery. Survivors are advised that the best treatment for people dying in pain is a crack on the head with a large stone. Well, that should certainly be within the government's projected budget for the NHS. Of course, mass destruction will not defend life or culture or human dignity, and I challenge my opponent, and I think the onus is upon her to do it, to show us how it will. But I know that my opponent might say one other thing, and as I'm moving towards the closing remarks, let me comment on it. I know there are a few gullible people around who will accept the point that it's the Russians. We've got to defend ourselves against all these Russians and all these Poles. Well, we like them sometimes, but not all the time. We've got to defend ourselves against them. And there are a few people who actually believe in the rhetoric. They believe that the dictators in Russia are socialist dictators. They believe that the Russian bombs are bombs for liberation. And in falling for this mythology, as many Russian workers have done, and I've spoken to many who have, they have been taken in no less than workers in any other country by the myth that you can support your own interests by supporting the needs of profit. And there are propagandists in Russia, just like my opponent, whose task is to whip up nationalist feeling in the interests of imperial expansion. As a matter of fact, they're not just like my opponent. I was actually reading a speech by one the other day. It's got the same name as my opponent. or half of it. She's called Olga Grabenovich. I mean, you know, you disagree with the Ben bit, I know. And it struck me just how ideologically hollow and how dangerous its rhetoric is, wherever it comes from and in whatever language it is uttered. Somebody has suggested to me that we might be able to start up a multilateral comedy show called The Two Olgas, guaranteed to die laughing. But anyway, I want to conclude on this, that there is an alternative. It's no good just saying what we don't want. There is an alternative to abolish the system which needs to sacrifice people for profits, to establish a society in which the resources of the world belong to the inhabitants of the world. And why, in a society which is based on common ownership and democratic control, where the world at last belongs to the people who, in a democracy, it's got to belong to, its inhabitants, why would people then want to go to war when you've got rid of the institutions of property, when you've got rid of the institution of the market and of profits and of all of the socially anachronistic features of capitalism? In conclusion, I would urge my opponent to remember two things. Firstly, the Socialist Party is not concerned to oppose one weapon as opposed to another. As far as we are concerned, the rubber bullet on the streets of Belfast is just as obnoxious as the cruise missile. The SS-20, the Exocet, the chemical and biological weapons, whoever controls them, whoever's finger is on the button, we are against them all. They must all be removed by removing that which is their cause. And secondly, let me remind my opponent that the Socialist Party is not appealing to capitalist governments of either side to disarm unilaterally or multilaterally. The futility of expecting governments to run a system of ruthless competition without the most hideous violence is like petitioning muggers to extract money from their victims by means of gentle persuasion. It can't happen. There are those who think you can run capitalism peacefully. There are those who think that you can civilise warfare. The Socialist Party rejects those ideas. And that is why, because my opponent's arguments are so much part of the perverse logic of capitalism, you've got to make an important and urgent choice. Will you surround yourselves with the means of destruction in the false hope that the reason for their creation will not lead to the reason for their use? Or will you organise politically and consciously to establish a society where the missiles are in the museums and we can all listen to tapes of Lady Olga Maitland and we'll be able to say, it's lucky we learnt in time.